Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture titled Missionaries, Snakes, and Survivors, Depictions of Africa with the Poisonwood Bible. Speaking will be freelance journalist and travel writer Thomas Kilduff. Tonight's lecture is presented by the African Studies Center at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by Professor Edward Boustan from the African Studies Center.
Tom Kilduff describes himself as a travel writer, a freelance writer. He's also a teacher, actually. One thing he is not, or he doesn't claim to be, is an Africanist. And I think it's refreshing that we should, in this series, sometimes bring in someone whose contact or interest in Africa derived from unusual sources. Tom tells me he became interested in the Congo after reading Barbara Kingsolver's Poisonwood Bible, and I think that's quite a legitimate way to become interested in Africa. What he does with it, however, is related to his teaching activities, and he has used Barbara Kingsolver's novel in a classroom context to essentially introduce students, secondary school, high school students, really, to what might be called the sort of multinational or multicultural dimension, which too often is absent from English lit courses. So we have, as I said, an unusual speaker and presumably an unusual presentation that I think we're going to enjoy. So, Tom, floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here. And, yeah, I just want to reiterate I'm coming from an English and a liberal arts standpoint, but I have deep respect for the Department of African Studies, and I was just floored by this book. I just think it's a great text, and there's so much here to work with. So once again, this is a curriculum for high school and or undergraduate college students, giving them a template for creative writing opportunities through deep reading of this wonderful book. It's intended for students to come to know and retain a familiarity with one of the most biologically rich regions of the world, and also one with a brutal 19th and 20th century history. Quick summary, Virginia-based writer Barbara Kingsolver published The Poisonwood Bible on February 2nd, 1999. Within a year and a half, it became a runaway bestseller with the help of Oprah. This is an Oprah Book Club selection. And it's basically about, it contains five alternated narratives, what they call multiple person narrative in fiction, namely that of Orleana Price, who's the wife of the Christian missionary Nathan Price, and her four daughters, Rachel, Ada, Leah, and Ruth May. All the narrative is given by woman. In 1959, Nathan Price moved his family from coastal Georgia to the DRC, or at that time the Belgian Congo, for a Southern Baptist mission. Being strangers in a strange land with no electricity, each of the family members learns to survive or not, facing their whiteness, Americanness, and faith, while gathering the affection or suspicion of the local tribespeople, led by Tata Endu, the village chief, and Tata Kuvundundu, the religious leader of the village. When the patriarch starts to lose his sanity and his humility, the Price women are forced to survive and muster the strength in a misogynistic and racist world. So there are eight areas we're going to cover today, or eight ways that students can approach the novel: geography, ethnobotany and ethnozoology, budding feminism, sibling rivalry, biblical allusions, religious collision, other literary allusions, and creative writing opportunities. I just want to emphasize that one reason I think this novel is so superb is that, you know, it shows how historical upheavals work best for character development and plot suspense. In this case, the 1960 independence of the Congo. In each of these aforementioned areas, there is this continuous misnavigation and misreading of barriers, whether they be cultural, historical, ecological, or biblical. So that's a running theme we find throughout the novel. So I just want to reiterate, you know, that once again, one of the reasons Kingsolver crafted her novel around the real historical events of Congolese independence is that this shaky transition in leadership, it created a real aura of suspense for the characters, especially this oblivious missionary family from Georgia. In this way, she's combining fiction and nonfiction, which is something we see increasingly more, for instance, in books like Falling Man by Don DeLillo, which centers around 9/11, as well as Trance, a lighter book by Christopher Sorrentino, which centers on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst in the 1970s. One idea we should think about is the master narrative. He who names gets to control. We see the Congo going through 5 or 6 different names throughout the novel. It's first known as the Kingdom of Congo with a K before Portuguese explorers came. Then the Congo Free State. Then the Belgian Congo until 1960. Then briefly the Republic of Congo, Zaire until 1987. And the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So naming is so important here. And the three older Price girls deal with language and naming in their own way. And I remember as a school kid, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when the USSR had suddenly dissipated and it had shrunk to just a country called Russia. So I want these kids to understand that it's so political, naming and language. Suddenly, I remember seeing, you know, the Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. I'm going to ask for a little bit of participation throughout the lecture. Can you guys think of any new countries that have popped up in the last 10 or 15 years? New names? Kazakhstan. Yep. Kazakhstan. Yeah, sure. You know, Kosovo, East Timor. Or countries that we start hearing about, whether due to calamity or things of that nature. What are some of the animals we can think of in the Bible? Any that come to mind? Camels?
Lions.
Lions? Snakes is a big one. Sheep, fish. I mean, there's quite a few. So, you know, even though we live in, you know, the suburban USA now, I mean, I think our relationship with animals probably begins and ends with cats, dogs, maybe horses. But ethnobotany and ethnozoology is of critical importance to the Congolese today and certainly during the novel in 1960. Ethnobotany and ethnozoology is how a culture and people relates to their plants and animals. Another thing to think about, we love our man's best friend, we love the dog in this country, but in some African and Arabic countries, a dog is looked at as a vile creature. And then I want my students to know that even in China, dogs are considered a delicacy. Yet we eat hamburgers with abandon in the USA, while in places like India, it's considered a sacred animal. So moving on. One huge motif, one important tree, is the poisonwood tree. It stands as a major player because it stands as a motif that is arrogant about everything that is arrogant about Nathan Price and his missionary family. For instance, by trying to use the tree as a source of firewood, Nathan develops a burning rash and loses credibility among the local people. You know, he looks foolish. And scientifically, the poisonwood tree is called Metopium braunae. The sap of the poisonwood tree is extremely toxic and causes blisters. And even the leaves are extremely toxic. You can actually break out in hives just standing near it if you're sensitive to it. However, it is a source of red berries and food for many local birds. But it's something you have to be very careful about. Kingsover also refers to the poisonwood tree at various points throughout the novel. Here's a quote from Ada, who's sort of the brooding intellectual twin sister of Leah. "Tata Jesus is Bangala," declares the Reverend every Sunday at the end of his sermon. More and more, mistrusting his interpreters, he tries to speak in Kikongo. He throws back his head and shouts these words to the sky. while his lambs sit scratching themselves in wonder. Bangala means something precious and dear, but the way he pronounces it, it means the poisonwood tree. Praise the Lord, hallelujah, my friends, for Jesus will make you itch like nobody's business. So we come to understand that Kikongo is a tonal language, meaning that one word can have many different meanings depending on how you pronunciate it. So every week, Nathan, the fiery minister, is doing his best to speak Kikongo and tell people what to believe and how to feel. You know, he mistakes precious and dear for poison wood. Obviously, this, you know, there's a lot of comic relief in this, but it kind of forms the basis of the whole novel, is that whatever your intentions, however good they are, yeah, you can cause a lot of harm with not knowing it. And it also, you know, going back to how he handled the poison wood, by not knowing, you know, how a culture deals with their crops, you can really become quite marginalized. At the close of the novel, we catch up with Ada, again, the dark-minded, brooding sister. And as an adult, she became a doctor, much to her own surprise, and collects misprinted Bibles. It's kind of a strange hobby, but she's a strange girl. Here's a quote from 533. "I can't resist these precious gospels. They lead me to wonder what Bible my father wrote in Africa. We came in stamped with such errors, we can never know which ones made a lasting impression. I wonder if they still think of him standing tall before his congregation shouting, 'Tata, Jesus is Bangala.' I do. I think of him exactly that way. We are the balance of our damage and our transgressions. He was my father. I own half his genes and all of his history. Believe this, the mistakes are part of the story. I was born of a man who believed he could tell nothing but the truth, while he set down for all time the Poisonwood Bible." Moving on, a big staple of the Congolese diet is cassava or manioc. I'm just going to read you a quick quote about manioc. This is from Orleana Price, the mother, who, of course, has to do a lot of the cooking. Something we also see is, you know, one unfortunate area where they agree is the disrespect of women, both in American culture at this time, 1959, 1960, as well as African culture or Congolese culture, where the women seem to be doing all the work. "What on God's earth did they eat? At length, I learned the answer, a gluey paste called fufu. It comes from a stupendous tuber which the women cultivate and dig from the ground, soak in the river, dry in the sun, pound to white powder, in hollowed-out logs and boil. It's called manioc, I was informed by Jana Underdown. It has the nutritional value of a brown paper bag with the added bonus of trace amounts of cyanide, yet it fills the stomach." Scientifically, we actually come to know that it's a huge staple. It can contain cyanide, but is a huge staple of the Congolese diet. It's extremely tedious to grow, so even though she says it has the nutritional value of a paper bag, I think she just was tired of cooking it. In most of the cassava-growing countries of Africa, the leaves are also consumed as a green vegetable, which provide protein and vitamin A and B. You have to be careful of that cyanide, though. Okay, moving on. Don't get too scared. It's only a picture. The green mamba snake. Obviously, in the Bible, the snake has had a hard time of it. And also, at least in Kinzover's Congo, the green mamba snake is best to be avoided at all cost. It can fit in looking like a vine, so it's very ubiquitous and looks very harmless. Ruth May, the youngest of the Price girls, is obsessed with the green mamba snake. She almost wants to grow up and be one. So let me just read a quick quote from Ruth May. "I said to him, 'Where is all the green mamba snakes? I know they live up in a tree so they can drop on you and kill you, and I wanted to see some.' Mr. Axelroot said, 'There's not a thing in this world hides as good as a green mamba snake. They're just the same color as what they lay up against, he said. And they don't move a muscle. You could be right by one and not know it. And later in the chapter, while spying, the boy said, Patrice Lumba. I told Leah that means the new soul of Africa, and he's gone to jail, and Jesus is real mad about it. I told her all that. I was the youngest one, but I knew it. I lay so still against the tree branch, I was just the same everything as the tree. I was like a green mamba snake, poison. I could be right next to you, and you would never even know it. So the fact that she's so obsessed with the green mamba snake, Kingsolver's using a literary device called foreshadow, because I'm assuming most of you had read the novel, so we know the demise of Ruth May. Okay, moving on. Owl is another one. And owls call out to the Bakinda, spirits of the dead. The owls, hungry like everyone else, looking for souls to eat. The owls croon and croon, and the air must be thick with the spirits of children dead. In Kalanga, where most of the action takes place, the owl is looked upon as a harbinger of death, a collector of children's souls. So when Leah, one of the twin sisters, decides to adopt one, the whole village is up in arms, and they treat it with disdain, and they can't understand why she's doing this. And so soon enough, a lot of the children are dying from an outbreak and stomach sickness. And it's not so much that the village blames the Price family because of the owl, but it adds to a litany of items they treat with suspicion. Again, another misnavigation between with ecological barriers in ethnozoology. It doesn't help the fact that Nathan Price wants to baptize everyone in the river, the same river where a child was eaten by a crocodile. So again, misnavigation, a misread, and not asking the people if they are interested in their Christian God, how they best want to go about it, you know. A sense of arrogance we see. Another animal, the jungle rooster. Into the jangled pieces of road, little jungle roosters step from the bush, carcadoodling. They jerk up with their feet with cocky roosterness, as if they have not yet heard about the two-legged beasts who are going to make slaves of their wives. Here we see a technique called anthropomorphism, attribution of human characteristics to a god, animal, or thing, which we see sometimes in the Bible as well as in the Poisonwood Bible, albeit with a completely different set of animals. Lastly, on the animals thing, this is one creature that has caused a lot of turmoil in one tumultuous chapter. Ants. We were walking on, surrounded, enclosed, enveloped, being eaten by ants. Every surface was covered in boiling, and the path like black flowing lava in the moonlight. Dark, bulbous tree trunks seethed and bulged. The grass had become a field of dark daggers standing upright, churning, and crumbling in on themselves. At the tail end of The Judges, which is one of the seven books within the novel, Leah returns back to their ramshackle house with ants in her mind shortly after the ant raid of the village. For the first time that night, I thought of our poor chickens shut up for the night in their coop. I pictured their bones laid clean and white in a pile on top of the eggs. 2 days later, when the rebel army of tiny soldiers had passed through Kalanga and we could go home again, that is exactly how we found our hens. I was surprised that their dislocated skeletons looked just the way I'd imagined them. This is what I must have learned the night God turned his back on me, how to foretell the future in chicken bones. It's kind of an eerie passage. So here, you know, Kingsolver is not using anthropomorphism, but rather she's using the ants as a plot device and as a motif for Leah losing her faith. Scientifically, driver ants are found all throughout West Africa. There can be up to 20 million in a single colony. Their habitat is rainforest and savanna, and they'll feed on any animal life in their path. Driver ants hunt by swarming, and they can dismember up to $100,000 prey animals in a single raid. So nobody warned the Price family about this, you know. Again, a linguistic barrier and a dose of arrogance in there. Anybody recognize this woman? Rosie the Riveter? Budding feminism, it's a running theme throughout the novel, is how these five women grow up and survive despite the absence of their increasingly maniacal father. Also, we start the story in 1959, the closing of the Eisenhower era, when gender roles were neatly delineated within the nuclear family. In a way, the roles of the Price woman were even more predetermined because they came from a Southern Baptist background, a faith that, according to the Guardian newspaper, believed that Eve was created second to Adam and was responsible for original sin. They ordained that women must be subservient to their husbands and prohibited from serving as deacons, pastors, or chaplains in the military service. So again, throughout the novel, we see the three surviving Price daughters grow into womanhood from 1959 until the late 80s, again, kind of on their own. However, their paths were quite varied. For Rachel, the oldest and dim-witted beauty queen, she was married three times until she inherited a fancy hotel catering to American and European elite staying in the French Congo. For Leah, who's the genius tomboy of the twins, she did find a man, Anatole, who she had always respected and grew to love. Anatole was an African teacher, and they had four boys together. Theirs is an egalitarian relationship, and they lean more towards a communist mindset after seeing the ravages of American political interference. And Leah and Anatole do end up settling in Angola. For Ada, who remembers the brooding genius twin sister, she finds refuge in her work as an epidemiologist in Atlanta, spending time with her mother and reading Emily Dickinson. And for Orleana, we have her back in a small town outside of Atlanta, growing her own food in the backyard and helping out with the civil rights cause in the city of Atlanta. So the first Price woman to stand up to Nathan, the maniac, is his wife, Orleana. I'm just going to read you a quick passage. "Father said they are living in darkness, broken in body and soul, and don't even see how they could be healed. Mama said, well, maybe they take a different view of their bodies. Father says the body is the temple, but Mama has this certain voice sometimes. Not exactly sassing back, but just about nearly. She was sewing up some window curtains out of dress material so they wouldn't be looking in at us all the time and had pins in her mouth. She took the pins out and said to him, well, here in Africa that temple has to do a hateful lot of work in a day, she said. Why, Nathan, here they have to use their bodies like we use things at home, like your clothes or your garden tools or something. Where you be wearing out the knees of your trousers, sir, they'd just have to go ahead and wear out their knees. So here we have where a woman's compassion meets logic, you know, two things that are sorely missing in the character of Nathan Price, the evangelical Baptist missionary. So when we look at the whole family, when it comes to a woman's survival, we have the man-eater, the politically minded wife and mother, the single scientist, and the aging civil rights activist. I think Kingsolver is also laying out a design for women to survive any way they can, much like Africa. And you'll see a parallel between Africa and a woman throughout the novel. Here's a quick quote from Orleana. "I trusted too long in false reassurances, believing as we are all wont to do when men speak of the national interest that it's also ours. In the end, my lot was cast with the Congo. Poor Congo, barefoot bride of men who took her jewels and promised the kingdom." One other thing, just going back to the baptisms in the river. When it comes to St. John in the Bible, there are very few crocodiles in the Bible. So we have to remember that. Again, another example of religious and ecological misnavigation on the part of Nathan. Biblical allusions. There are several. I'm just focusing on a few here. The book of Job, Cain and Abel, Daniel and the lion's den, and Sodom and Gomorrah. just a quick note about sibling rivalry. We have the twins, Leah and Ada. And they are Cain and Abel in the novel. Cain and Abel, the first children of Adam and Eve, born after the fall of man. Once when they were grown men, both Cain and Abel offered sacrifices to God. When Cain saw that Abel's pleased God, whereas his did not, Cain murdered his brother out of jealousy. For his crime, Cain was exiled by God to a life of wandering in a distant land, which is something we see with Leah, who chose to stay in Central Africa, specifically Angola. Quick quote. This is from Ada, who remembers the handicapped, brooding sister. My right side drags. I was born with half my brain dried up like a prune, deprived of blood by an unfortunate fetal mishap. My twin sister Leah and I are identical in theory, just as in theory we are all made in God's image. Leah and Ada began our life as images mirror perfect, with the same eyes dark and chestnut hair. But I am a lame Gallimaufry, and she remains perfect. Oh, I can easily imagine the fetal mishap. We were inside the womb together, dum-de-dum, when Leah suddenly turned and declared, Ada, you are just too slow. I am taking all the nourishment here and going on ahead. So she grew strong as I grew weak. Yes, Jesus loves me. And so it came to pass in the Eden of our mother's womb, I was cannibalized by my sister. So these girls are brought up with such a religious mindset that they kind of look at their own life circumstances through a biblical lens. Also, the whole Cain and Abel thing, it very well could be an analogy for the relationship between Africa and America, whereas once they were joined at the hip, you know, with Pangaea and spread apart, one suffers while the other benefits. There's quite a few. There's the book of Job. Nathan is always comparing himself to Job, and the story has to do with the nature of suffering. And remember, there are both explicit and implicit allusions to the Bible, especially when we read this novel. One quote he gives is, "Only God knows when our relief may arrive, but God does know, and in his benevolent service we will stay." This is after they received a warning from the U.S. State Department that independence was coming and a lot of white people were being killed, but he chose to keep his family in the jungle, kind of abdicating his role as a father to be one of God's soldiers. So he sounds like he could be Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now, the way he just kind of goes into the woods and becomes more of a man of God than ever. When it comes to religious misnavigation, we have Nelson, who's one of the village friends of the girls. He implied that the Christian God put a curse on Job after hearing one of Nathan's lectures on Job the previous Sunday. He gave him the pox and the itches and killed all seven of his children under one roof. Leah defends her God. Oh, Job, I said. Why, that wasn't a curse, Nelson. God was testing his faith. Upon first hearing that story, it kind of does sound a little cursed, you know, especially if you don't speak English and the pastor doesn't speak Kikongo. You could see that, once again, this is a linguistic misnavigation, something that adds to the suspense of the novel. Daniel in the Lion's Den. According to the Dictionary of Cultural Literacy, during the captivity of the Jews in Babylon in the 6th century B.C., the prophet Daniel continued to pray to his God against the express command of the king. As a result, Daniel was thrown into a lion's den to be devoured. But God sent an angel to protect him, and he emerged miraculously unharmed the next day. So we want to think about Daniel's situation is an image for an impossibly hostile environment. Quick quote. This is relative to the fact that Ada, who remembers the brooding handicapped sister, was almost eaten by a lion. And there's a lot of rumors around the village that she perished. This is a couple days after the fact. People seem to think that if Jesus could stop a lion from gobbling up a poor lame girl, he must be staying awake pretty good for the Christians. Ha! Just when everybody was thinking their regular African gods were aggravated with us and fixing to teach us a lesson, the way they see it, it was kind of a wrestling match between the gods, with Jesus and Ada coming out on top. Father, of course, says this is superstitious and oversimplifying matters, but as luck would have it, he preached the parable of Daniel in the lion's den just a few days before. So naturally now they are knocking each other over to get to church on Sunday. So, again, whatever sermon they hear, they'll take, you know, and in a place where there's such a high level of infant mortality, any religion that promises salvation seems like a good idea. Another one is the Tower of Babel. In the book of Genesis, a tower that the descendants of Noah built, they intended that the tower would reach up to heaven itself, increase their reputation, and make them more like God. God prevented them from completing the tower by confusing their language so that they could no longer understand one another's speech. From that time forward, according to the Bible, the peoples of the earth would be scattered, speaking different languages. One quick quote. This is Nathan speaking. 200 different languages, he said, spoken inside the border of a so-called country invented by Belgians in a parlor. You might as well put up a fence around sheep, wolves, and chickens and tell them to behave like brethren. He turned around, looking suddenly just like a preacher. Frank, this is not a nation. It is the Tower of Babel, and it cannot hold an election. If these people are to be united at all, they will come together as God's lambs in their simple love for Christ. Nothing else will move them forward. Not politics, not a desire for freedom. They don't have the temperament or the intellect for such things. I know you're trying to tell us what you've heard, but believe me, Frank, I know what I see. Again, complete arrogance and an oversimplification of matters. And comparing the Congolese to people in the Tower of Babel when all they want, you know, is a free country. Another one is Sodom and Gomorrah. This is more of an implicit reference. It's not explicit, not stated so much in the novel. Basically, we see Orleana as Lot's wife. In the book of Genesis, Lot's wife is a disobedient woman whom God punished. God sent angels to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah for their wickedness, but chose to spare Lot and his family. The angels commanded them to flee without turning back to look at the destruction. Lot's wife did look back and was immediately changed into a pillar of salt. In my view, at least, Orleana is cast as Lot's wife with a sense of irony. First off, Nathan, a wannabe contemporary stand-in for Lot, did not protect his family as Lot supposedly had, and Nathan's family wasn't spared, although he did pinpoint the village several times as the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. The only way for Orleana and her remaining daughters to survive was to be disobedient. Toward the end of the novel, Orleana portrays Lot's wife in that she was constantly looking back at Africa, both physically and emotionally, on what Africa had done to them and what they did to Africa. According to Ada, towards the close of the novel, having served enough time in Atlanta with her volunteer work, Mother has moved to the Georgia coast, to a hamlet of hoary brick houses on Sandrine Island. When I go to visit, I always find her out in the walled garden with her hands sunk in the mulch, kneading the roots of her camellias. If she isn't home, I walk down to the end of the historic cobbled street and find her standing on the seawall in her raincoat, with no shoes, glaring at the ocean. Orleana and Africa at a standoff. Implicitly, an ocean of salt water separates Orleana from Africa. And might we surmise that she shed some salty tears in the process? Maybe Kingsover is saying that it's inhumane not to look back. Okay. Religious and cultural collision. Again, the whole baptism thing with the crocodile, not the best way to get people to become Christian. So many cultural misnavigations and misreads. Another one earlier on is the hired assistant to the Price household, Mama Tataba. She keeps specifying that if he wants to grow his garden, he has to make huge mounds to protect it from flooding, instead of doing it the American way. But the Reverend insists upon his own way until he, after enough flooding, he surrenders to her suggestion. For a moment, we think this is going to be a different type of novel altogether, because we see a glimmer of humility, but we know we're sorely mistaken. It's funny, my landlord is Nigerian, and he makes, it does look like burial mounds. He makes has a garden in his backyard, and it's a vastly different way of gardening. Again, a huge cultural difference. And of course, a big one is the poisonwood tree. It stands for everything bullheaded about evangelism. Another cultural collision, which I'm going to save for you as readers, because they're just so brilliant, has to do with the chapters on polygamy for survival and Jesus by democracy. They're just brilliant. So, moving on. Other literary allusions throughout the book: Mark Twain, Swiss Family Robinson, Robinson Crusoe, Things Fall Apart, and Heart of Darkness and Apocalypse Now. Robinson Crusoe, Ada is a big reader. She says at the beginning, "Every house has only a single square room and a thatched roof, under which might dwell the likes of Robinson Crusoe." Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, there's quite a lot of spying going on, especially Ada and Ruth May spying on Anatole and Axelrod. So this reminds me of Tom Sawyer spying on Injun Joe. Also, another parallel is when word that Ada is almost eaten by the lion spreads, she hides in a tree and gets to see the prelude to her funeral. This is quite similar to Tom Sawyer attending his own funeral, hiding in the pews. For a moment there, in the first book, which is Genesis of the novel, we have this adventure story. So we think it's going to be like a good old-fashioned adventure story like the Swiss Family Robinson. But of course, the Poisonwood Bible takes many twists and turns. Things Fall Apart, the ultimate post-colonial novel. Again, you'll see this this parallel more with characters that are in both Poisonwood Bible and Things Fall Apart. Characters being, you know, actual Africans themselves. Heart of Darkness is the book version of Apocalypse Now, as many of you may know. So many of Ada's ruminations on life, death, and Africa could read right out of Joseph Conrad. This is Ada's favorite poet, mostly because both women are loners, intelligent single women, who give a lot of weight to words. A quote: "Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me, or paused to at least to strike a glancing blow with his sky-blue mouth as he passed. And oh, how dear we are to ourselves when it comes, that long, long shadow in the grass." Again, that's Ada, but it could be Emily Dickinson. So in conclusion, there are so many creative writing opportunities. This book provides such a template for students to get interested in Africa and interested in writing. Just want to remind people, you know, I created this curriculum for high school and college undergraduate students to be schooled in the ways of the Congo, not just to be schooled in the ways of the Congo, but rather to share with them a template. Barbara Kingsolver's newly independent Congo could easily be replaced with Nathaniel Hawthorne's Colonial Salem, J.D. Salinger's Adolescent Manhattan, or Amy Tan's Imperial China. I think it's so important to give students a sense of time and place that will help improve both their history and their reading and writing skills simultaneously. Although it was published in 1999, the Poisonwood Bible could well replace Things Fall Apart as the it novel about Africa and about misjudgment when it comes to high school curricula. Or at the very least, it could become more of a contemporary alternative. Obviously, there's so much I did not cover in regards to the novel, like the nuances of politics and the use and abuse of language and narrative by the five main characters. some creative writing opportunities, specific assignments that students could garner from the curriculum is they could follow King's Over Steps and create a short story of their family moving to another country, or in the case of science fiction, another planet. You know, what would the people eat? How do they govern themselves? How do they grow their crops? Or they could take the Bible stories and make contemporary versions of it. You know, does Jesus wear New Balance sneakers? Where do you meet him? Or some other characters in the Bible. Or combining fiction and nonfiction, as Barbara Kinzover brilliantly did, you know, students could focus on real-life events, 9/11. Where were the characters during 9/11? How did they feel about it? Where were they during the election of Barack Obama? Things of that nature. So reading the book can be a gateway for further study into any of these offshoot subjects, and hopefully they'll come away with a deeper appreciation of Africa and the DRC, and an understanding that it's more complex than we think. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted to hear this presentation for all sorts of reasons. One of them is that I've been working, like most people in this room, for decades, writing either plain old history or plain old ethnography, purporting to be nothing but nonfiction. Of course, there may be some who think that aspects of what we write are fiction. But while we do this, I think we do it in the awareness that what people want to read is stories, and that if one were to write a book called The Experience and Effect of the Missionary Presence in the Middle Congo River between 1959 and 1960, whatever, it might sell anywhere between 300 and 1,500 copies. And Barbara Kingsolver has written the same book as a story, and as we know, it goes by the truckload to this day, and may do so for centuries. Why are there people who are like us, banging our head against the wall and writing things that the public doesn't want to read?
Gosh, well, you know, she uses so many... Such an interdisciplinary movement, you know, within the novel. Her view of Christianity is not all black and white either. I mean, there is a character, the Catholic missionary, Brother Fowles, who abandons his post, and that's where the Price family moves in and replaces him. And he becomes more of a hippie, you know, going up and down the Congo River and stays in the Congo and makes a real attempt to come to know the people, come to know the animals and the birds, and develops a criticism of the defining word of the Bible. So that's just one thing to consider. Also, I think Barbara Kingsolver may have been a little naive. She was completely supportive of Patrice Lumumba, but I'm sure there were problems, too, in his early administration. It didn't help the fact that he was assassinated, you know. But so she's kind of almost coming from a real communist standpoint. And from my limited knowledge, there was also this whole Soviet land grab, you know, and that's the reason why the U.S. got so – or land grab desire, and that's why the U.S. got so involved in – Congolese politics, but I'm sure you all know more about that. I mean, there's just so much going on in the novel, you know. Greed and the diamond business is a whole other area I didn't cover. So I guess there's just so much here, you know. I don't know what to tell you about your nonfiction pursuits, but
I totally agree with you, because I, just an example, and not Henry Marshall, Jules Marshall wrote several tomes for relating the history of the Congo before, I mean, the 1900. And when you had Adam Hochschild, who relied a lot on his works, and he wrote something that was maybe not a fiction, but was like really readable for the masses, that actually like really expanded the same thing that was written, but that was like too difficult to read for the general audience. But my question is, how, when you have this curriculum to high school and to undergrad, and with the vision or the way the Congo is portrayed today, how do they relate that together? Is it reinforcing negative views, or do you think that is actually, you see that there's more positive and they understand more? That's probably my question.
Well, once again, I'm not an African expert, but I went to the lecture here last week, and the gentleman who was given the lecture says that economic conditions may be the same as they are today as they will be 50 years from now without some substantial structural change in how we can lift the Congo out of its poverty. And, you know, there, in journalism, there's so little Africa has covered so little, except in publications like National Geographic or maybe more like the BBC. But the American media doesn't cover it that often, except when there's some sort of catastrophe. So that's kind of an onus on all of us and a responsibility of how we can get the word out about both success stories and the complexities of catastrophe and poverty. It's a tough one. I mean, but I would want to emphasize to them that this took place over a specific time frame, you know, and I would ask my students to research what the present government is doing now in the Congo.
If I may, it seems to me that when I read the Poisonwood Bible, I liked it very much, of course, but I saw it as a novel that was really about an American family, a specific type of American family, if you will, from the Deep South, from a particular religious background, not unlike that of a number of Protestant missionaries that I had actually met in the field in the Congo. But the novel, ineffectually, say, was more of an American story than it was an African story. Africa was there, something as a backdrop, if you will. And one problem that I've had with it is that the African voice in the novel is limited. There are a number of African characters, and they do play a part, but they're sort of a bit player. They appear, they sort of fit a certain, well, shall we say, stereotype, and then they vanish or they reappear. The story is really about about the family, about the women in the family, perhaps. Do you wish that there had been more of a part for the African side of the story, if you will?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Anatole is an African whose point of view does come across quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he's essentially it. So in the hierarchy of power, we see white men on top, white woman as the main narrative of the voice, and then Africans down below. So I would love to hear more stories that have more of an African narrative, you know, which we see, we do see with Things Fall Apart. So it's interesting. I think Kingsover does draw a lot of parallels between Africa and woman throughout the novel. But they still, because of the color of their skin, they still do have, they're able to get away with things, you know. So yes, I would like to read more about African narratives.
Yeah, that's why I thought that, you know, you mentioned Things Fall Apart, for instance, or other such writings by African novelists. And in their case, of course, it's the perspective is entirely different. There are European characters that appear in Things Fall Apart, but they're seen through African eyes. And that makes a whole lot of difference, in fact. You know, I wish, in a sense, that even though the African perspective is represented by people like Anatole or by in a number of villages, the chief and so on and so forth, that we had been given a chance to view the American characters, the Western characters, through their eyes, in effect, and how they react to it, the way that we do in Chinua Achebe's novel. They are there, in effect, shall we say, to present a sampling, if you will, of African people in the eyes of the Protestant missionary family. But the missionary family is not seen directly, at any rate. It's seen indirectly, but it's presented in terms that are intended to appeal to us Western readers rather than to Africans. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one dimension that's missing. You know, it doesn't detract anything from the literary merit of the book, of course, but it does mean that there is a one-sidedness to it, which is probably inevitable. And I don't know if you think that this can be remedied by using other works of literature in class, for instance, to sort of compensate for mm-hmm. this difference in perspective.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the book sales are like in Africa for the Poisonwood Bible, whether it's been translated in, you know, Kikongo, Swahili, I'm sure it's translated in French, and to see how African readers have taken to it, if at all. So yes, I think if anything, I don't think it'll replace Things Fall Apart, but maybe as you suggest, a surrogate or an alternative text.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by freelance journalist and travel writer Thomas Kilduff, titled Missionaries, Snakes, and Survivors, Depictions of Africa with the Poisonwood Bible. Tonight's lecture was presented by the African Studies Center at Boston University. Our speaker was introduced by Professor Edward Bustan from the African Studies Center. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney, with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.